Very much. That's a very wonderful response and welcome, and I deeply appreciate it. It's great to be in North Carolina and great to be at Southeastern to be able to spend a little bit of time with you, but in all honesty, it's even better to be out of Washington, D.C. for the day and to come to North Carolina to stand with Robin Hayes, who I believe is exactly the kind of man of faith that we need at all levels of government. I just wanted to take a couple of minutes with you this morning to perhaps say the obvious, but sometimes the obvious needs to be said. And that is that America is in deep, deep trouble. You don't have to be a policy wonk like me in Washington, D.C. to know that. Half of our marriages ending in divorce, a third of our children born out of wedlock, 1.5 million abortions a year. We all read the headlines. Mothers strapping her children to the back seat of a car and sending it to the bottom of a lake. A little seven-year-old in Chicago thrown out of a fifth-story window because he wouldn't shoplift for two 11-year-olds. Family in Los Angeles that makes one wrong turn, and before they get off of that street of killers, their three-year-old is dead of sniper fire. I think there's a sense that we all have that America is one wrong turn away from a disaster. I think something's gone wrong with the heart and soul of America. And I think the first explanation for what's happened is that the elites of our country have forgotten God. And having forgotten him, they've unleashed the hounds of hell on our streets and neighborhoods and families. And that's a pretty ironic thing to happen in America. The founders saw this as a shining city upon a hill. Lincoln called this the almost chosen people. Every one of us have in our pockets money that says, "In God we trust." And the phrase has become as devalued as the money it's printed on. You know, when you're in Washington and you visit the monuments, if you go to the Lincoln Memorial and the Jefferson Memorial and the Washington Monument, you will see at every one of those places the words of our founding fathers, the words that make it clear that our liberty comes from no man. It doesn't come from Bill Clinton, doesn't come from Bob Dole, doesn't come from five magical votes on the Supreme Court. Our liberty comes to us from God, and it's guaranteed to us by the original contract with America, the Constitution, and the Declaration of Independence. I'm here today not only to help Robin Hayes, but also to encourage you, because in a few years, you're going to be out in the public square. And being in the public square, you and only you can explain to the American people why we must have racial reconciliation, because we're all children of God. You're the only ones that can explain why the sanctity of human life matters, because we're all created by God. You're the only ones that can explain to our fellow Americans why it is that only a virtuous people can remain free. I hope you'll be bold enough to do that. I hope you'll be bold enough to stand with people like Robin Hayes, who believes in those things deeply. I'm convinced that if you will do that, if you will speak the truth in the public square, that we have a good chance of making America a shining city upon a hill again. But more importantly, I know that it will mean that someday you and I will hear the words we all yearn to hear, "Well done, good and faithful servant." So I give to you Robin Hayes, a good man of faith, a man who believes in family, faith, and freedom. I hope you'll consider him in the week ahead, and I hope you'll listen carefully to his words. God bless you all. Thank you very much.
Good morning. You all are seeing God's grace at work this morning. For me to follow Gary Bauer is unbelievable. It's not what should be happening. Folks, in Romans it says, and I agree, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. It's the power of salvation to him that believes, first the Jew and then the Greek. As Gary so eloquently put it, it's not the economy. It's not the economy. We're facing a morally bankrupt country. Politics do matter. If you don't care about politics, politics cares about you. I look out into this audience and see workers headed for the vineyard. And I'll pray for you today and in the coming years that you will reach the people in this land who need to know the love, the salvation, the warmth that comes from a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. That's how we turn this world around. I came today and I heard this from a Baptist minister several years ago. He said, "I didn't come here to comfort the afflicted. I came here to afflict the comforted. Folks, we've got some problems, and we have to take our place in the arena. I want to hold up something in front of you today. You may not be able to see it, but this is a rose. It's made of condoms. This is what's being handed out in schools and in other places by the so-called safe sex educators to our children. You know, what kind of message does this send? As a father, mother's here, the message says, safer sex is a gift of love. Say it with roses. Where have we come in our society that we're letting people have our children and send them this kind of message? It's time for a change, and it can come only from a spiritual source. These are the kinds of things that are taking our country down. In North Carolina, we have a taxpayer abortion fund. $11 million of tax money had been used to perform 50,000 abortions. That is simply not right. We stopped that in 1994 when we had a change in the House of Representatives. I'll close by simply saying to you what Alan Keyes has said before me. And it's the powerful message that I want you to remember when you consider what you're going to do on November the 5th and on election days that follow. Alan Keyes said, the issue in this election is not Bill Clinton's character. It's the character of the American people. We have the power to sound the trumpet that will awaken even dead hearts. It's up to us to awaken dead hearts across this land to the spiritual starvation that's driving our country down the road to destruction. It's up to us. We have to earn the right to share the gospel of Christ with those we meet, whether it's in the political arena or in the church pew. Dr. Bob Pierce said one time, we have to earn the right to share the gospel of Christ. And I see you earning that right. And I'm here, I hope, to encourage you. We need you out there as quickly as possible. Come prepared, because there's a lot of hurt and there's a lot of pain that can only be healed through that saving knowledge and that personal relationship with Jesus Christ. So thank you for letting Gary and I come today. It's a pleasure and an honor to be with you. Let's bow in prayer. Heavenly Father, I see before me young men and women who are there equipping themselves to go out and lead, to lead your people. It's been said that we must preach the gospel everywhere we go, and that's certainly true. But it was also said that we should only use words when we have to. Let the lives that we lead, wherever they may be pleasing in your sight. But let those lives draw people to the love that comes from you, you who gave us your only Son as the ultimate sacrifice for the sins of man. We thank you for your faithfulness, your grace, and mercy. We plead for that mercy today because we are all standing before you as sinners. We thank you and ask you that you would help us be to others as you have been to us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thank you so much for that. It ties into what I want to talk about today, which is a blending of methodology along with preaching the gospel. My topic this morning is virtual theological education, cyber training for evangelism and discipleship. As we approach the 21st century in theological education, education is at crossroads. Costs of theological education are rising, funding sources are declining. The task of world evangelization requires a greater number of trained personnel if we are to attain our stated goals of reaching people across the globe with the message of Jesus Christ. Unless the church can furnish greater numbers of thoroughly equipped and trained workers, the hope of reaching the world will only remain nothing more than an unfulfilled dream. Let me highlight the problem in its world context today, the magnitude of the problem. According to the World Evangelization Database, the status of global mission of the church in 1996 indicates the following. World population at 1900 was 1.6 billion. By the year 2000, it will be 6.1 billion. By the year 2025, it will be 8.2 billion. Christian population has also increased. 558 million in 1900, which was 34.4% of the population. Now, this is Christians of all kinds, so it is not necessarily those that we would consider who have necessarily given their lives wholly to Jesus Christ. In the year 2000, it will be 2.1 billion, and again, 34.4% of the population. But by the year 2025, it's estimated that we will have 3 billion persons who are Christians, and 36.9%. At a time when, as Gary Bauer and the candidate for governor were pointing out to us, at a time when the United States is changing its role in relation to Christianity, the decline is from 88% in 1980 to 85.7% by the year 2000. The rest of the world is coming to a relationship with Jesus Christ. About 20% of our total foreign mission force, which includes the 62,000 in 1900, 420,000 in the year 2000, and 550,000 in 2025, 20% of that force, or 83,000 cross-cultural missionaries are working in evangelism, 20% of that number are working in church planning and discipleship. To accomplish the task, it has been estimated that we need another 300,000 workers who are trained, equipped, and ready to go if we're going to reach the world for Jesus Christ. In his final appearance to the disciples, Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth is given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." We have not lived beyond the extent of that command. Jesus also said, then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send forth workers into his harvest field." These commands necessitate the preparation of leaders and workers to evangelize, plant churches, discipleship, disciple, and teach. Our goal in this paper is to find ways to prepare leaders more effectively. We turn next to the concept of paradigms. Our outlook in life is dominated by the paradigm through which we view life. Thomas Kuhn, the philosopher of science at the University of Chicago, used the term paradigm to indicate the particular perspective that represented a unique way by which persons view science. We may view life in that manner as well. An illustration of this, in the late 1960s, the watch manufacturing in the world, the leader was Switzerland. A group of Swiss watchmakers had developed the quartz crystal watch, but the new watch did not have springs, gears, or working parts. The Swiss did not even register the patent of the new technology. Seiko of Japan changed the course of watchmaking by seizing upon a new paradigm which didn't have working parts. Japan, which had almost no share of the world market in watchmaking, now was catapulted to number one. And the watch that I wear today is a Seiko. The paradigm had shifted. Thousands of Swiss watchmakers were put out of work, and Switzerland lost its position in watchmaking. When a paradigm shifts, the previous leaders may be replaced. Success is now measured by the new standards, not by the old. My thesis in this paper is that teaching and learning and the way higher education is transacted in the United States is in the midst of a paradigm shift that will radically affect the future of seminary education, seminary extension, and even church education in the United States. In many ways, this paper is a continuation of the work I did on my doctoral dissertation about 20 years ago at another Southern Baptist seminary. It was entitled "A Comparative Study of a Low-Budget Learning Environment and Enriched Curriculum on the Achievement of Behavioral Objectives." I know, it's academic. At the time, we were looking for a means to enhance the learning process in theological and church education without the use of computers, because at that time they were prohibitively expensive. That dream, using telecommunications and computers today, may be realized. Let me state early in the paper that I do not agree with the megachurch pastors who suggest that seminaries have outlived their usefulness and will become an anachronistic relic of the past. It is certainly possible that some seminaries may, through inadequate support from churches, die. But if churches allow seminaries to die, I believe that it will be to the peril of the church in general. Seminaries provide a significant unifying factor in the life of the church. When a seminary loses its purpose, the churches suffer. Historically, that can be demonstrated. Conversely, the reason why seminaries came into existence in the first place was that the apprenticeship program for young theological students failed to provide underlying foundation for ministry. Churches established the seminary to equip pastors for ministry. We should not return to follow a pattern that has already proven to be a failure. Paradigm shifts in theological education. Nevertheless, the paradigm of seminary education is currently shifting in at least two ways. The first is in the area of teaching and learning in a technological context. Technology is changing the teaching-learning process in every area of theological education today, and in general education as well, from kindergarten through graduate school. Through technology, it is now possible to achieve the medieval ideal of personal mentoring of a student, even within a large group setting. In the minds of most people, the term technology means machines. James Finn points out that technology in education includes machines, but it also includes the integration of machines with humans. And so what we have is an interweaving in technology of human components as well as non-human components. The curious thing about the use of educational technology is that it is not necessary to mass produce educational experiences of students, but it may have, in fact, the opposite effect of actually individualizing instruction more effectively. Technology is finding its way into educational programs of a number of seminaries, according to a recent article in Christianity Today. Included in the list are Fuller Theological Seminary, Gordon Conwell, Westminster, Asbury, Bethel, and New Orleans. The second paradigm shift concerns the movement from resident education programs to distance education programs. It is possible to teach with traditional didactic lecture format by allowing a professor to teach a course on the home campus simultaneously with the teaching that goes on the distant campus. The technology allows an institution to find cost-effective alternative means for teaching both at home and at a distance in a traditional format in higher education. Technology also allows a professor to teach students on the home campus and in the homes of students on each of the continents across the globe. One of the most interesting things that I read about as I was preparing for this paper was a study that was done at the University of Pennsylvania, where a teacher of St. Augustine had 10 students in his class, in a seminar class, on an annual basis. This changed radically when he went on the internet, and now he has a class of over 1,000 students located on all the continents of the world. One advantage of distance education learners receiving instruction by computer is that they do not have to be present at the time the instruction is given. They may be sleeping while the instruction is given locally and receive the assignments and download the lecture material at any time during the day or night. Verduin and Clark state the definition of distance education, which is from an unpublished paper, any formal approach to learning in which the majority of instruction occurs while the educator and learner are at a distance from one another. Theological seminaries are becoming involved in this form of learning through the television and computer media. In addition to those seminaries mentioned previously from Christianity Today, Southwestern Baptist Seminary has also been involved in distance education using teaching a course in hermeneutics across the United States. Both the use of technology and distance learning are departures from the traditional lecture classroom model. Certainly, I do not believe that distance education is the only mode by which seminary education will be done. I do believe that seminary that is not engaged, however, in distance education by the turn of the century will find itself less able to compete favorably for quality students, faculty, and funding. The paradigm shift will favor creative and technologically based programs. The technology will not only affect distance learning, but will significantly affect on-campus teaching as well. Before proceeding, let me briefly examine the origins of distance education. The earliest mention of distance education in the United States goes back to 1728, which in the Boston Gazette, there was an advertisement for lessons being taught in shorthand by mail. But more recently, after the war in 1865, the Chautauqua movement was born on Lake Chautauqua in New York State. And the Chautauqua movement was an attempt to teach Sunday school teachers to prepare them. And so the Sabbath Day University was born as a result of that and chartered back in the late 1800s. Out of that came extension programs at the University of Chicago because William Rainey Harper, who was then working in the Chautauqua movement, moved over in 1895 to become president of the University of Chicago, and there he carried his extension program as well. This later degenerated into general education, and that's where the Chautauqua movement is today. Moody Bible Institute also founded a program for teaching Sunday school teachers during that same period, and in 1901, they opened their Moody Correspondence School, and that is still running today with respect to teaching Sunday school teachers. But unfortunately, one of the problems of correspondence learning is that, as many educators have pointed out, it may lead to 40 to 90% dropout during the period of time. But lest you think that there are no people taking correspondence courses, the international correspondence schools, even today, while we're speaking, enroll between 70 and 100,000 students annually, and since their opening in 1890, have trained some 8 to 10 million persons over that period of time. In theological education, distance education is not new either. When I was at Bethel Seminary and directing the continuing education program, I had a Lilly Foundation grant to study theological education by extension and continuing education programs at other seminaries. Two seminaries that I visited that made a difference, one was Princeton Seminary and the other was Perkins School of Theology. Both of them had correspondence type programs. A pastor could join a group and read a series of books and receive continuing education unit credit as a result of that. They were non-credit, and I think that's the important point. Both of these programs are a form of correspondence, but notice that there is a significant paradigm shift here in the way we use remote distance education today as opposed to the way it was done then. While the Princeton and Perkins programs were peripheral, providing non-credit programs, the newer programs are for course credit and part of the regular instructional program of the seminary, and this is only going to increase in the years ahead. With the improvements in instructional technology, distance education has experienced a renaissance. The number of learners enrolled in distance learning programs and completing those programs has risen dramatically. The British Open University has demonstrated a model of effectiveness for distance education programs. OU attracts between 60 and 70,000 students each year. OU courses include a study guide, a set of instructional videotapes for student use, and there's a wraparound written materials which guide the learner through the videotapes. Today there are at least, now get this, there are 142 programs, baccalaureate programs, by which you can, through distance learning, obtain your baccalaureate degree, totally by distance education. There are 61 graduate programs that will lead even to the PhD level, and these are fully, many of these are fully accredited. These programs may be found in every area of the world. There are additional programs known to exist in Eastern Europe, although and we know that they exist in Russia, but unfortunately they did not respond to the survey, and as a result we don't know exactly how many of those programs are in process today. The International Council for Distance Education estimates that approximately 10 million persons are engaged in distance education learning today. What are some of the modes by which distance learning takes place? Well, choice of a particular media must be according to available resources and the instructional purpose for which the media will be used. A set of criteria for the appropriate mode might include objectives, what is it you want to accomplish, the media, what kind of media are going to use to do this, how motivational is it, what availability does it have, how about the skills of operation? The skills of operation are probably not so much of a problem for the students as they are for the faculty. Control, who will retain the control of the teaching, and what aesthetics, how does it appear aesthetically? Is it a pleasing kind of thing or something that's that just really gets in the way? What about time and place? One of the things that's interesting about distance education is that you can have programs which are specific in terms of time, or you can have programs that can be taken at any point in time as far as the person is, and they can contact back to the faculty member in the institution by either phone or on the email. The cost, what is the selected media, what does it cost, and is it possible for the sponsoring institution? And as I'll point out, one of the problems that we face in the seminary is because we don't have unlimited resources like, say, the University of North Carolina has, so that they can do broadcast television, we have to resort to other means in order to be able to accomplish this. But there are four basic formats that are in operation today in distance education. One of these is print. We've already talked about that with respect to correspondence-type programs. But one of the things that is significant about print is that almost invariably, even if you use other means, like visual or audio-visual kinds of things, you also have a wraparound material which goes along with it, which supplements that material and guides the learner through the learning process. The audio media consists primarily of voice and music instructional materials and probably have limited use for what we would want in seminary education. Video media, during the last two decades, television has dominated the distance learning market. Television is usually very expensive route to follow, and it allows the learner as well as the teacher to use and view iconographic images that the instructor may want to use. One of the ways that this has been used effectively in theological education is to take the present series, for example, on Islam, and to have a wraparound printed set of materials to go along with it, in which that is mailed to the learner, and he or she works through the process and through the program all the way to accomplish the instructional goals that the seminary desires for the student. A new and affordable option, which has come available recently, has many benefits of two-way video and two-way audio, but without the prohibitive cost. This is the compressed video format. Compressed video digitizes the audio and video signals and reduces the excess signal without reducing the information presented. Compression makes transmission possible across telephone lines, which therefore lowers the cost and makes it possible. There may be some slight distortion, but even that is being put out of the is less of a problem today. This option provides seminaries with a viable alternative to placing a seminary professor on a location in a remote extension center. New Orleans Seminary is using this option extensively, and I want to talk about that a little further along. Teleconferencing, whether video, audio, or audiographic, requires time-bound involvement of both the student and the faculty person. We move next to computer media, and this is probably an awesome teaching device, the most awesome that has ever been invented, but would not be useful in distance education without the use of the internet. The advent and evolution of the internet and its World Wide Web integrates all of the functions that a computer can do effectively and makes seminary distance education by computer possible. In 1969, the United States Department of Defense created ARPA, or the Advanced Research Projects Agency. Agencies of the government and universities became linked on what evolved into the internet. In 1986, the National Science Foundation created the NSFNet to facilitate research, and this was linked to ARPANET. That was the beginning. From that point on, there's been a continual evolution of attaching and linking computers, one computer to another, until you have this vast, complex, huge, monolithic network that exists worldwide. But that's not all. Cyberspace and groups of people join together in virtual communities as a result of the internet. As the net expanded, it was necessary to develop systems for retrieving information from the complex network. The result were retrieval groups like Telnet, for example, which allowed connection to thousands of libraries. You can today, on the internet, tap into thousands of libraries across the world. The University of Minnesota, whose mascot is the Golden Gophers, established the gopher as a net. And you can see that little gopher wending its way through the vast complex of computers to find the information that you're looking for. And in a matter of seconds, you can have it. Archie is the nickname of archives, which will search over 2 million files in a matter of minutes. And then there's Veronica, and this is the one I really like, very easy rodent-oriented net-wide index to computer archives. But that's not all. In 1989, the World Wide Web was born in Europe at the European Center for Particle Physics in Geneva, Switzerland. Hypertext files soon expanded into hypermedia files containing text, audio, and images. Linked to the internet, this system is absolutely awesome. The user base on the net has expanded from 100,000 users in 1990 to 4 million users in 1992, and it's anticipated that by 1999, there will be 100 million users on the internet. But what does all of this have to do with education? Internet access vendors like CompuServe and America Online have opened cyberspace to the average person with a computer. Ellsworth lists 8 functions that the net performs for educators. Professional collaboration among educators. Students collaboratively involved in investigations. Students and teachers access to scientific expertise. Students and teachers access to information such as libraries. Students and teachers access to computers and software, collaborative development of delivery of instruction and materials, teacher education and enhancement, electronic publishing of student products. And one of the things that was very interesting, I was looking for the data that I had at the beginning of my talk about world population and all that sort of thing. I was having a great deal of difficulty finding this until I happened to be surfing the net Saturday evening, and I ran across on one of the latest statistics on world population, evangelization in the world, Christian workers in the world. The whole thing is in 5 pages here, and I pulled it off the net in a matter of minutes. Teaching and learning in a theological context. As the paradigm shifts in favor of blending distance education with residence programs, the paradigm of teaching and learning a theological education will also change radically. CD-ROM now, for example, this ad that I have from Sage Publications, for $60, you can have a library on 4 CD-ROMs of over 200 Bibles, commentaries, theologies, word studies, dictionaries, and so on. Included on this are the whole set. I don't know if you've ever looked at that set, but one of the things that I really value is the set of Nicene, Anti-Nicene, and Post-Nicene Fathers. They're all on these 2 CD-ROMs for $60. CD-ROM resources and the internet obviate the need for a professor to lecture exclusively to giving content. You don't need to hear all the content because all the content is available to you now. Students will have access to a wealth of resources. On several CD-ROMs, a student can have enough resource material for an entire seminary education. Logos is producing a set of CD-ROMs that by the end of this century, by the year 2000, they will have over 3,000 books, a complete seminary education on CD-ROM. But the student will need, and this is what the CD-ROM can't do, the student will need guidance and understanding and using what is available. How does one make sense out of the plethora of commentaries that are available on one disk? Original resources will be available in theology that were only available possibly in very closed sections of the library in the past. In writing about distance education, Verduin provides a model for higher education. It is divided into 2 phases with 3 steps in each phase. They are the following. Phase 1 is planning. Assess entry behavior, specify behavioral objectives, specify learning unit and procedures. Phase 2, learning operations. Present learning unit and tasks. Student performs and learns, assess the performance. Good teachers have always performed these tasks, but the changes in teaching and learning because of technology in education today will affect at least 4 areas. First, in assessing entry behaviors, teachers will need to do more than give lip service to different learning styles. One of the things that we have known for a period of time now, since the 1980s at least, is that Kolb, David Kolb and Gregoric and Honey and Mumford have put together learning inventories which will tell what kind of a style you learn best, by which you learn best. It will no longer be advisable for faculty members to treat all students with the same cookie-cutter approach to providing the same learning experiences. A faculty member will need to diagnose the style of each learner and design learning experiences that will reach each member of the class individually. The 80-question inventory of Honey and Mumford identifies at least 4 learning styles, and it's one, as I said, of several such inventories. But he talks about, or they talk about, activists, those who like problems and like to be challenged, theorists, those who like to sit around and think all the time, pragmatists, those who only see the value when it comes immediately before them and don't want to hear all the rest of that stuff, reflectors, those who contemplate and do painstaking research. Each style represents the need of learning experiences that will be relevant to the student with his or her styles. Now you say, well, what relevance does that have to the church? Same thing. The people that you have in your congregations are representative of these same kinds of learning styles. Second, in planning for instructional procedures, Ellsworth lists 10 types of learning procedures that may be performed in standard classrooms but are now valid for distance learning as well. Each of these can be employed in the seminary context. And the interesting thing about it is that what we have done primarily in the past is didactic, that is lectures oriented, now is going to need to be expanded. Collaborative learning, demonstrations, didactic teaching, of course, which is lectures, discovery, inductive approaches to learning, drill and practice, gaming, interactive discussion, problem solving, simulation, and that includes case studies. Case studies lend themselves very well. And it's very interesting. I downloaded a number of case studies just in the short time that I've been on the internet. I downloaded a number of case studies that have come off the net that can be used in classroom situations. They're very useful. And the kinds of thing that a church can do with these certainly would be very useful in helping to prepare people for being evangelists and for the kind of teaching that they need to do in the church. Tutorial is the last one, which allows the teaching of new concepts and principles, but also assists the learner with remedial help. Third, at both the planning and implementation stages, the teacher needs to work to facilitate student learning in ways that have not been necessary in traditional classroom instruction. Ellsworth identifies four such tasks that can be true both in electronic classrooms as well as traditional classrooms. They are community building, fashioning intellectual opportunities, fashioning contextual systems, and supplying closure. One of the things that has to happen on the internet or by video is you need to bring some closure to the learning experience. It's not enough just to give material, but closure has to come at some point. And that's where the faculty member needs to interject his or her involvement in the learning process. Fourth, there will be the need for help with instructional design. Given the multiplicity of requirements for the preparation of courses to be taught by distance education, even things like how do you assess learning styles and so on, the professor is unlikely to have this kind of expertise if his area of expertise doesn't happen to be in that particular area. And therefore, he's going to need help with effectively designing instruction. He can benefit from the assistance of a course designer. This is a person who knows learning styles, visual effectiveness, media, how to facilitate learning, and works well with other persons. These are a few of the implications that flow from teaching and learning that need to become infused in the teaching learning process, not only through the internet, but right on campus as well. We turn next to two case studies of accredited schools that are using distance education effectively and may provide cost-effective models for the seminary. As the paradigm of theological education shifts toward distance learning, there are two fully accredited seminaries that are constructed models that may be emulated. These models are cost-effective and possess characteristics that meet needs of distance learners. The first is the compressed video format of New Orleans Seminary. Faced with rising costs of transporting faculty to their centers, they turned to compressed video as a medium. The compressed video format permits two-way interaction between professor and student. With both cameras and microphones present on both locations, the professor can watch the students of the class in New Orleans at the same time observe the students in North Georgia. He may view the hands raised, the questions or comments, but he may also see the facial expressions, which are so much a part of good teaching. Students in the North Georgia campus may see the professor, but may occasionally see their fellow students in New Orleans. The video signal is digitized along with the audio portion and is transmitted over telephone lines. The seminary pays a flat fee to the telephone company that is related to the estimated amount of usage. Stan Wilkins, the assistant director of the North Georgia campus, said at first they had some difficulty with the quality of transmission, but they obtained a T1 cable connection, which has almost eliminated all of the distortion, and now it's just like almost like broadcast TV. And what I saw when I was there supported that. During the fall semester, this past fall semester, Dr. Joe Troll, professor of Christian ethics, is teaching an ethics course to 10 students in New Orleans and 50 students in Atlanta. He is using compressed video to teach at the remote center. With compressed video, the task of interacting with the students is not significantly different from the task of teaching live in New Orleans. He admitted, as we talked via the television, because he was in New Orleans and I was in Atlanta, he admitted that at first it was a little awkward trying to see students' hands waving in the air by video, but once he got accustomed to it, he now enjoys it and he finds it very stimulating and finds the involvement with the students on the distant campus as intriguing as that on his local campus. When queried about the reaction to the use of televised medium for instruction, one student responded that he would much rather use the approach that he is experiencing in Atlanta then uproot his family and quit his job and go to seminary someplace else. Dr. Dukes has suggested that many seminary students in the future will earn all of their academic credit through distance education. Let me say here that I guess one of the problems I have with that is that I think somewhere along the line, and this is true of the computer media too, somewhere along the line we have to do something with like spiritual development, and I'm not sure that you can do that either by compressed video or through computers. So I think there'll have to be something built in which will strengthen that area at least. Let me turn to cyber learning at Bethel Seminary. My second example comes from Bethel Theological Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, who recently launched its in-ministry Master of Divinity program. Dr. Tom Johnson, Executive Vice President, told Christianity Today in an interview that the seminary developed the online teaching program in order to help pastors and would-be pastors, the same thing as was true at, in North Georgia, to stay at home at their home locations and yet have access to seminary education. He stated, quote, "People find they need more preparation but are locked in, whether by finances, schedules, or logistics, and don't feel free to come to campus for an extended period of time. An advantage of this kind of learning over compressed video is that it does not require a group to be present on one location. Students may be spread across the United States or even the globe. While personal contact may be somewhat limited, it does exist, and most importantly, access to theological education is available to the student. Students opting for this mode of education begin by examining the homepage of Bethel." And I'm sorry that it didn't come up. We had some technical problems, but I had the homepage off of the Bethel network in the video, but as you can imagine, it took a tremendous amount of memory, and transferring it back and forth didn't work too well. But it's very interesting. You really, if you have access to the internet, you ought to get into the Bethel homepage and some of the others and see what a fantastic job they do. The syllabus outlines the dates for assignments, and the course is organized around six components. Campus-based classes. One of the ways that they handle the problem of spiritual formation is that they bring all of the students who are in the distant learning locations have to come to Minneapolis or St. Paul sometime during the summer in order to participate in a 1 or 2 week seminar. Personal telephone and voicemail. A telephone call to the professor provides interaction. And the neat thing about that with voicemail, it can be 24 hours. So you really have access. If you want to study at 2 o'clock in the morning, you can do it, and you can call your professor and leave a message. Now, you won't get a response at 2 o'clock in the morning, but at least you'll get a response back as a result. The telephone conferencing allows 12 students, the way Bethel does it, they allow 12 students to be on a conference call, and they talk for a period of 1 to 2 hours, 1 half to 2 hours to 1 hour. And these conferences can either be general, or they can be instructor-led. Then there is computer conferencing. The student can talk to the professor, other class members, and even the seminary by four means on the computer. One is email. Second is discussion threads, which are topics that are carried through in which you can download material and upload material. Program information from the general information and announcements, which allow the student to keep relevant with what's going on at the seminary. And course materials. Through course materials section, the student can review content of not only the course that he or she is taking, but also other courses that are being taught by Bethel as well. And then finally, the internet resources, and that is absolutely incredible. Things such as the full text of Christianity Today articles can be had from back since its inception if you're looking for materials there. And that's only one of many magazines and periodicals that are available on the net. In addition to the general course materials, the syllabus presents typical course assignments, expected outcomes, and so on. Work completed in the course is not that different from traditional classroom instruction, but it permits the student to remain at home and still gain the benefits of a seminary education. In summary, Bethel's deployment of cyber learning appears to be a very effective approach to maximize the skills of the instructor, the resources of the seminary, and the resources of the internet to the benefit of all. Now, how does this all apply to the things that we talked about at the beginning, the task of the church? Distance learning by compressed video or internet is no panacea for all the needs of the church. Distance learning does provide some effective means for dealing with some of the problems that beset preparing men and women to fulfill the Great Commission. Let me outline just three different ways, and then I'm through. One is the local church. The local church can use the internet to provide relevant information to its members. It can produce and administer courses in new member orientation, evangelism, Bible, church history, geography. What the Chautauqua movement attempted to do originally, homeschoolers may be available on the net. Through the internet, the local church may provide care and prayer for its members. A prayer site may be maintained. Direct contact with missionaries in a matter of seconds is possible, and members may become related to the mission program of the world. Members who need to be away from church on Sunday can keep up with what's going on by simply dialing in the homepage on the net. Seminary Extension. Seminary Extension may provide courses and other pertinent information to pastors at remote locations via the internet. Similar to the International Correspondence School, the Seminary Extension may even score the tests electronically. With immediate feedback, the student in Seminary Extension can benefit from quick turnaround time. Finally, it comes to seminary education. Distance education can realize savings in transportation, room, and board for faculty traveling to distant centers. Compressed video becomes a cost-effective means to enhance course offerings and numbers of students in a class. It is efficient and effective as a means of teaching others simultaneously with teaching students on the home campus. One can compare the use of traveling on the information superhighway with Paul traveling via the Roman roads for his purpose of evangelization. While the infobahn, if I may use the term, may not be the best location from which to evangelize, it can be used effectively to prepare evangelists, church planters, disciplers, pastors, and teachers. The teaching may occur either with time parameters like Higher Education Today or without time bounds to meet schedules of persons who may not have difficulty meeting at certain times. There are uses of the internet and the World Wide Web on the local campus as well. They will allow globalization of resources. If the topic is literacy, there may be websites, many websites, on which you can get information and pull down data. Faculty may give written and immediate feedback to students. This happens at a lot of universities today, through email on the internet. Students can carry on a dialogue with their professors and with other students through email. Many written resources are available on websites across the world. Databases may be accessed that provide information that our forefathers only dreamed existed. Discussion lists on the internet open a wealth of discussion to theological topics, and library resources are one of those databases that are absolutely incredibly helpful. Problem-solving, gaming, simulations, to mention only a few from the list of those that I read earlier, are forms of teaching that can be used on the internet. One day, virtual reality will be available for new pastors to engage in a church fight. They can watch it on the internet. Many other possible uses, and determine how they solve it, of course. Many other possible uses of distance learning and the internet exist. We must not lose sight of the purpose for which we prepare men and women for service. Paul states it this way: it was he who gave some to be apostles, some to be prophets, some to be evangelists, and some to be pastors and teachers, to prepare God's people for works of service, so that the body of Christ might be built up until we all reach to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God and become mature, attaining to the whole measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. Whether in the church, seminary extension programs, or in seminary, we prepare persons to reach the world for Jesus Christ. Distance learning, compressed video, computers, and the internet, and the World Wide Web can be tools to help us do a more effective job of reaching the world for Christ. Thank you.
Well.